Welcome to Strat, and I have a few things I'm going to be talking about today. Basically, I'm going to talk about what's been going on, this rapid pace of events. In fact, when I talk about this, I realize that everything I say will probably be dated because things are moving so quickly. And so I'm going to talk about what's happening with the, dare I say, peace talks or attempts for peace talks or something along those lines. I'm going to talk about what's happening with this Alaska summit that took place, this amazing meeting with 9 world leaders at the White House, and kind of where this is going and put some background on this thing. So basically all about ending the war in Ukraine, although there's a lot of different variations and things. And one thing I say, and I am on the news constantly and have been on the news constantly talking about this, that there's only so much we can cover. And there is some background stuff that we sometimes don't get into. So first off, this meeting in Alaska was held on Friday, August 15th. All right. And it was at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, right near Anchorage, Alaska. I haven't actually been on the base, never had a reason to actually go on the base, but I have been up by the base. I've been there where the turnoff is and stuff, driving up that area. And it kicked off, you know, President Air Force One came in with President Trump, and then Putin came in with his plane, which surprisingly seems to be operational, considering Russian maintenance, aircraft maintenance standards. But, and they landed, and there were F-22s. Now, there are F-22s up there. That is a fighter base, amongst other things, and they rarely go out there and intercept Russian aircraft that are flying international airspace, but right near Alaska. And when I say intercept, I don't mean they're shooting them down. They just go out there and keep an eye on them. But there was a B-2 flyover with fives. And I find it interesting. You know, a lot of people are saying, well, this is undue homage or whatever to Putin and stuff. I also kind of say, yeah, but that's also a demonstration of U.S. power and strength and making a message to Putin that we have some incredible power. Now, I will say, having a meeting like this on a military base is very unusual. However, this is really fast. This happened within a week. There's a tremendous amount of security considerations that they have to put in. So putting on a military base in that context kind of makes sense. It was probably not enough time to do it anywhere else. So it really kind of made sense to do that. But it was a very unusual meeting. It was a highly anticipated summit, to say the least, and it went off. It was very cordial. They said some nice things, but it was very strange. Well, first off, two things. Number one, they greeted each other very, very odd. They greeted each other on the red carpets, which was not odd itself. But then Trump invited Putin to ride in the Beast, the presidential limousine, to go to where they're actually meeting. I find that interesting. I got to tell you, if I was Secret Service, I'd be going through that back seat area completely looking for listening devices or anything else. Putin, you can take him out of the spy service, but you can't take the spy out of him. And I'm sure that he probably had something, you know, I wouldn't put anything beyond him. Let's just put it that way. And they rode over there and they had this cordial meeting and praised the meeting as very, very positive and constructive. Although nothing really concrete came out of it. It was for Putin and Russia, this was a huge propaganda victory. The pariah leader of the pariah state was suddenly being feted on the world stage by the most powerful leader of the world and greeted and talked to in a very cordial way. I thought it was very strange at the end. The press conference wasn't a press conference. It was more like a press briefing. And there was nothing concrete. There was nothing significant put out in that entire. It was just, you know, Putin kicked it off, which was very odd. Normally, Trump comes out with these things and says some words. I mean, that's just, I've watched him over the years. He can't resist. He loves the cameras, and he normally says something. He didn't say anything. He just came out. His body language was very strange. It was very, very, very down for Trump. He looked a little bit stiff. I mean, he wasn't being angry or anything lacking in cordiality, but he just looked very stiff for President Trump. And then Putin went off and did this long diatribe stuff in Russian and then finished it off saying, hey, maybe we can meet next time in Moscow. And then President Trump kind of Said, yeah, I don't think so. I said, I'd be in a lot of heat if I did something like that. But it was a very strange thing. And then off they all went. And it was just, and then all the spin factor becomes afterwards. But it was a very interesting thing. It was very, very odd the way I think. Now, they talked about being extremely productive. They talked about being constructive. But they said they agreed on some things, but they wouldn't say what those things were. They say they disagreed on some things. They wouldn't say what those things were. It was, pardon the expression, trumped up to be a really big summit. But when it came out of it, I think everybody was feeling a little bit nonplussed, which is what exactly happened there, other than the fact that, you know, Putin got to show himself off, getting the red carpet treatment in the United States. It was very unclear if anything constructive came of that. But as I said on the air recently, in working peace deals, it's kind of like making sausage, and nobody likes to see how the sausage is made. So maybe you could say this is part of the sausage, you know. Maybe this was, you know, you go in there and you have to, you know, pump up Putin, so to speak, in order to get him to actually engage. So we'll see if that actually turns out. But Trump said the talks would not, I should say Trump went into this thing basically saying that the success, if they didn't get a ceasefire, it wouldn't be a success. He walked out of this thing saying that if there wasn't a ceasefire, there would not be a ceasefire. They're going for a full peace process. And it was very, very strange that that he just dropped that completely, the whole thing for a ceasefire, and just went for this peace process thing altogether. And so that's what kind of came out of this deal. And obviously the Europeans and the Ukrainians were a little nonplussed on that as well. And they didn't talk about, he said he wasn't going to talk about territorial swaps. They did not talk about territorial swaps, but that is truly the elephant in the room, is this thing about territorial swaps. What he's alluded to, that Putin had agreed to some sort of security presence, if you will, security guarantees, and it really was kind of ambiguous, still is rather ambiguous, what he's agreed to. It sounded like initially he'd agreed to that there would be a peacekeeping force, maybe a very substantial peacekeeping force, and he didn't discount that the U.S. would be part of the peacekeeping force, but it was very interesting what came out of it there. Now, he left. There was a lot of stuff going on Sunday very quickly, but I should mention that on Sunday, President Zelensky met with European leaders, and they met in Brussels for a Monday meeting in Washington, D.C. at the White House that took place. Now, one of the things I should mention before I get into land swaps too much, or the whole issue of land swaps, is that when Steve Witkoff was over in, before they had that meeting about a week before, Steve Witkoff was over in Russia meeting with Putin, and came away with the idea that Putin was going to give away Kherson and Zaporizhzhia Oblast, which is all those areas north of Crimea and south of the Donbass. He's going to give those areas back to Ukraine. In exchange, Ukraine would give the rest of the Donbass, which is Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast, to Russia. And currently about a third of that Donbass area is land that's controlled by Ukraine, not by Russia. All right. So he was very enthusiastic about that. Within a couple of days or 24 hours or whatever, that whole notion seemed to vaporize. And I think the Kremlin, as far as I could tell, shot it down, said, no, that was not discussed. That was misunderstanding, blah, blah, blah. But that was originally some of this optimism on the land swap thing, that there was going to be this huge land swap. And honestly, if Ukraine was offered Zaporizhzhia, Kherson, Oblast in total back, I think that the Russian or the Ukrainian parliament or the Ukrainian legislature would have to seriously consider an offer like that, but that it apparently was not on the table. Right now, but it was big that Russia, at least President Trump says, Russia is willing to accept some security guarantees for Ukraine. So that is on the table, and that's very interesting to see. Now, Steve Witkoff told CNN that Russia had agreed to Article 5-like protections. Article 5 is the part of NATO agreement that says one for all for one, so to speak. But it includes military force, but if you actually read the language in Article 5, it kind of has an easy out, which is, you know, that if one is attacked, all are attacked, blah, 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 and every country has to respond as is appropriate, which literally could be, I'm sending half my military to fight the enemy in a neighboring country that they've invaded because they're part of NATO. All right, that's one way. But literally, you could also turn around and say, I'm sending a letter of strong support and I condemn what these evil outside invaders have done, and you just let me know how that goes. So it is a little bit vague in there. What makes Article 5 strong within NATO is we have this integrated command structure, integrated force structure, that if one attacks, the whole thing just kind of kicks in. That's how we're structured. And by the way, I would remind everyone, the only time Article 5 in NATO was ever imposed was when the U.S. was attacked on 9/11. So the only time all the NATO nations came together to fight a common enemy was when the United States was attacked. And I just want everybody to remember that before you think, oh, well, Article 5 is just all those Europeans who are getting a free ride or something. No, the Europeans took a lot of casualties fighting alongside U.S. troops in Afghanistan. And it wasn't so much under Article 5, but they also fought alongside U.S. troops as part of the Coalition of the Willing in Iraq. So I just kind of want to point that out in case anybody's having some historical memory problems there. So, but they're talking about doing something like that. But Article 5, even something like Article 5, which it wouldn't be Article 5 because they're not talking about Ukraine becoming part of NATO, it is kind of loosely written and it isn't as strong as a lot of people think it is. It doesn't automatically commit countries to sending troops. Now, going to this meeting in Brussels, President Zelensky met that Sunday after the Alaska summit with European leaders. They kind of obviously strategized, discussed, came up with a game plan, and then they went off to Washington, where they had a very cordial day, very positive discussions. Everyone was afraid that they'd see a repeat of what happened in the Oval Office in February with President Zelensky. That absolutely did not happen. President Zelensky did not wear military attire. He actually wore kind of a modified suit thing, which President Trump remarked upon, which, as you remember, J.D. Vance kind of remarked upon in February when he was in more paramilitary attire. Anyway, long story short, they met, even though President Trump has talked about going right for this peace process, kind of like Putin talks about going for a peace process. Both President Macron of France and Chancellor Merz of Germany specifically brought up the need for a ceasefire before there's any negotiations on a full peace agreement. All right. Now, I was kind of watching that closely because I wanted to see what President Trump's response was, because he had just shifted his position away from ceasefire to going right into peace discussions. I thought it was a fairly even-handed response. He didn't chomp at the bait. He didn't say anything. And when he's ready to chomp at the bait on something. But he didn't do that. He kind of just said, well, it'd be great if we could do that, but I don't think we can do that. I thought that was kind of interesting. Everyone came out very, very positive on what happened. There was a lot of praise by all these leaders for President Trump getting him to this point. There was a call somewhere in the afternoon to President Putin. Interesting, the call did not go at the very end of the day as it originally was billed. It went kind of in the middle of discussions. President Trump has a reputation of kind of sticking with whatever he heard the last person say. That's his reputation, all right, for whatever you want to say. And I think President Zelensky and the Europeans want to make sure that at the end of the day, they had the last word with President Trump. They didn't want Putin to have the last word with President Trump. They saw what happened on Friday when President Trump shifted his position pretty dramatically, in many ways kind of mirroring the Kremlin talking points. And so they wanted to very much make sure they had the last meeting. So what came out of this? Well, there was nothing huge that came. Well, I think something huge came out in terms of weapons commitments. I'll get to that in a bit. But they did say, hey, we need to go on to a meeting, either a bilateral, which means Zelensky or Putin, or a trilateral, meaning Putin, Zelensky, and Trump would be there. The bilateral is kind of interesting. Putin's position on Zelensky and Ukraine is Zelensky is not a legitimate national leader, and Ukraine is not a legitimate nation state, and they should be part of Russia, period. He's never changed that. That's his view. He does not see them as legitimate. A bilateral is difficult. I would think that Putin would have a tough time just shaking Zelensky's hand when they met. I think Zelensky would have a tough time shaking Putin's hand for that matter as well. But he doesn't see Zelensky as a foreign leader. He just sees somebody that they tried to kill multiple times that they weren't able to kill. All right. So that's an issue. By the way, where would they hold it? It probably would not be in the U.S. I've heard Geneva floated. I'm kind of curious, you know, Putin's got a problem. He's got an international criminal court warrant out for his arrest. So there's only so many places they can actually hold this thing. Turkey, the UAE, United Arab Emirates, I should say, maybe in Doha and Qatar. But there aren't that many places where they could hold it. How would it be conducted? How would it be moderated? I think the two of them just talking to each other directly, I don't know that that would be horribly productive overall, because I could see that thing going sideways very quickly. And for Zelensky, there's a serious chance that they're going to use this as a possible vector of attack, if you will, to try and take him out. Putin definitely sees Zelensky as a very symbolic force of Ukrainian nationalism, one of the things that's holding their country together, holding the resistance together to the Russians. And he's, you know, his services have tried to take him out many, many times. And that cannot be discounted that he would try to use this as a venue for assassination. So, you know, that's kind of interesting. And at the end of the day, the discussions were talking about maybe bilateral before the trilateral, whatever. But I think there's real difficulty there. The trilateral, and Trump offered, says, hey, I could be there at this meeting with you. And Zelensky jumped on that, said, boy, that'd be great. You know, let's do it. Let's make sure you're there. That actually is a lot easier, because for Putin, he's going to a meeting where President Trump will be there, the most powerful leader in the free world. That's a little bit easier politically for Putin to deal with, even though Zelensky will be there as well. And it might help mitigate the assassination threat to Zelensky as well. But again, there is a core problem with all these meetings, is Putin thinks he's winning. And as long as he thinks he's winning, he's not really engaged in doing so. He thinks militarily, if he can just wait everything out, he's going to win. So I think that, honestly, Trump seems to be more inclined to offer the carrot versus the stick. You know, he's really different from, say, Theodore Roosevelt, you know, speak softly, carry a big stick. I actually find Trump to be the other way. He tends to be very loud up front, making these big threats and stuff. And then, you know, he doesn't quite follow through. And right now, Putin has avoided crippling secondary sanctions or secondary tariffs being put on his oil sales around the world. Although India does have the 50% thing applied to it. But nothing like the 500% or 100% that he talked about before. Putin is avoiding these crippling sanctions, which could really stop his arms industry, or stop his ability to pay for the war. Now, one of the things coming out of this, going into this Monday meeting, there was $100 billion in arms that Europe's going to pay for, U.S. arms, U.S. military arms that will go to Ukraine. That was agreed to up front. That is a huge incentive for the U.S. to stay engaged and support Ukraine. And frankly, Trump, former businessman, money talks, or current businessman, whatever, money talks to him. There's also $50 billion in joint production in drones. The U.S. is way behind where they should be, specifically on tactical drones used on the battlefield. We're not where we need to be. Right now, Ukraine is the most innovative military drone country in the world by far. And so that $50 billion in joint production on drones is huge as well. Drones are part of a big U.S. initiative to get these things fielded, deploy combat-capable drones to our operational units worldwide. They even changed the procurement part of that to make drones like ammunition, so they didn't have to go through the same process for vetting and everything, because otherwise it would take years and years and years, and they got to get this stuff out there very quickly, so they changed it. A couple of big changes. Ukraine has a new drone out that's a fiber optic drone. That's by fiber optics. It avoids jamming from electronic warfare systems. That's been a huge problem on the battlefield. The Russians were the ones that started using fiber optic first. It's not a brand new technology. It's been around for a long time. But it does avoid that jamming problem. The Ukrainians are now using it greatly. They've now announced a drone that can go 100 kilometers with a fiber optic spool going out behind it. 100 kilometers. That is amazing how far that is. I just find that changes things a lot, all right? And it's not out there in mass yet, but when it is, I think it could change things on the battlefield quite a bit if they can produce enough of them. Ukraine across the board produces about, I think they're on track to produce about 4 million drones total this year. That's a lot of drones. Well, most of those are smaller first-person view battlefield drones, but still, it's an enormous amount of drones. Ukraine also has a new missile which is equivalent to the Tomahawk missile. If you recall the missile that we used in Iran, it's a big missile. It's called the Flamingo. Carries a 1,000-kilogram warhead. Has a range of about 3,000 kilometers, which is over 1,800 miles. It can shoot east of the Ural Mountains in Russia. It can even shoot into the Asian parts of Russia, basically bringing a lot of stuff in. Basically, any area that they want to hit that Russia uses to support the war in Ukraine, I think they can, with this missile, they can pretty much hit it. All right. Now, the issue of land swaps, there's some big problems there. One is Putin doesn't want it because he can't take that land in Donbas. That's a massive defensive zone. The Ukrainians control key terrain. They've got that thing really dug in well. So he wants to get that, and that's why he was pushing Trump to get off the ceasefire thing and go for the peace deal, because I think the last estimate I heard, it would take about 4 years for him to take that Donbas area that he doesn't control. So at the current rate of events. So that's just something he can't do. Ukrainians see this as land that was literally paid for, if you will, in Ukrainian blood, defending it. And the Ukrainian constitution doesn't give Zelensky the right to negotiate that away. All he can do is take it back to the parliament, and they have to discuss it and stuff, and the constitution has very significant process things he has to go through. So even if he agreed to it, it's very conceivable that he could take it back to Kyiv and be told, nope, that's not good enough. That's not going to take it. Now, there was that thing, there is that question about Zaporizhia and Kherson, those areas, Russia's. Russia doesn't want to give those up. Russia's saying, no, we want to freeze that area. We want to hold on to that where we are. And then we take over this area of the Donbas, and we give you these little tiny areas way up north, these little minor incursions up north, which really isn't much of a trade. It's right now what's on the table is Russia says, hey, we get a ton of stuff and you don't get anything. And that's really not much of an agreement. So the U.S., Secretary Rubio said, look, both sides are going to have to give on this one. And right now, nothing's showing that Russia is ready to really change its goals or its position on this stuff. So now, what will security guarantees look like? It's possible U.S. boots could be on the ground, but it's also possible the U.S. may be providing air support, other things, intelligence sharing, kind of like what it's doing now. But although we're not doing air support now, but what we could do is provide a lot of support for Europeans, and we could actually use some of our rotational brigades, army brigades, about 2,000 plus troops that currently go to rotate in and out of Europe, and it's possible one or two of those could rotate in and out of Ukraine. Certainly Britain, France, Germany, Italy could all put rotational brigades, or at least rotational battalions or something. And I was just kind of doing the math, and I came up with there could be about a, by the time it's all said and done, if they get enough people to sign off on it, there could be somewhere around the equivalent of a 2-division size international force, which is pretty good sized. You know, we're talking maybe 40, 50,000 potentially total troops that would go in there. I mean, that's possible. I'm not saying it's going to happen. That could be deployed there. And then the question is, where do you put them? What do they do? Things like that. What Putin's really worried about is he's got huge political economic problems at home. His numbers are somewhat bogus in terms of the Russian economy. And what he's fearful of, especially if those secondary sanctions get kicked in, is the Russian economy grinds to a halt. And then he sees a replay of what happened in 1991 or 1917, where the Russian government was overthrown. All right, so that's what he's fearful of, is his longevity in office. So we'll see how this goes. There's a lot to be worked out. I would say if you're planning on going out and buying confetti or setting up a celebration, you might want to hold off on that. There's a lot of really tough negotiating ahead. Hey, thanks for listening to Strat. Please go to stratpodcast.com. You can go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kempfer TV. You can go to my website, or my company's website, at GRIPSA for Global Risk Intelligence and Planning, gripsa.com. And thanks for staying tuned. It's a very dynamic, fast-changing world, and there's a lot to discuss.